I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Arnon Grunberg's new novel is called Phantom Pain. The main character in the story is a writer. Now, for much of his career, this character is not a very successful writer, but he has an insightful piece of advice that he leaves in a letter for his son. It goes like this. There is only one way to compete with a myth. There is only one way to escape a myth. There is only one way to keep yourself from playing an eternal bit part in someone else's myth, and that is to create a myth of your own, to become your own myth. Not surprising to imagine that the same words have held some inspiration for Arnon Grunberg himself, a kid who flunked out of high school as a teenager and bounced through a number of self-confessed failures. He went on at an absurdly young age to become one of the most highly regarded writers in the Netherlands, with a start to his career that had some remarkable acrobatic twists. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Grunberg now lives and writes in New York, and we'd like you to join our conversation this hour. For example, what difference does it make where a writer calls home? Does it make a difference? Are there European and American ways of looking at the world? And on that myth thing, is it the task of the artist to create his or her own myth, or is it simply to create and then let other people do the talking? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arnon Grunberg, welcome to The Connection. Nice to have you here. There's a story, I just alluded to it in the beginning of the program, from the early days of your writing. Your first book, Blue Mondays, was a runaway success. Won you the Anton Wachter Award for a debut novel in the Netherlands. That surprise you at all?
Yes, of course. And also many things surprised me because two weeks before the novel came out, my publisher went on a holiday to Greece and he told me, okay, I think it's a pretty good novel, but don't expect anything when it comes to sales. I mean, we are happy when we sell 2,000 copies. That's a lot for a debut novel in the Netherlands.
And that one sold a lot more than 2,000 copies.
Almost 200,000 by now.
So that alone made you something of a literary marvel in Europe, not just in the Netherlands. It was quickly translated into German. That was the next language?
German, Italian, French, Spanish, yep.
Now, several books later comes a book called The Story of My Baldness, right? You wrote that.
I wrote it, I have to confess. But officially, the author is called Marek van der Yacht.
That's the copy. That's the name on the copy of the book that I have here.
Yes.
And you were having a little bit of fun with that because you actually had this author, Marek van Yacht, challenging Arnon Grunberg, as two writers might duel a little bit.
Also,
right?
Before the book came out in the Netherlands, Marek van Yacht wrote a piece in one of the biggest newspapers in the Netherlands attacking a few other authors, among them Arnon Grunberg, for being too frivolous and don't taking literature serious enough.
It was still not the real Marek van Yacht. There is no such man.
There's no real Marek van Yacht, I hope so. Although, I must say, after the book came out a few months later and these rumors started spreading in the Netherlands that maybe Marek van Yacht doesn't exist, I got a letter from a man who claimed to be Marek van Yacht, and he even sent in a copy of his passport.
But then the unthinkable happens. The Story of My Baldness by Marek van Yacht wins also the Anton Wachter Award for debut novel in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Was that the moment when you had to confess you were the same person?
Not really. It was the moment that there was in a few newspapers, because I claimed this guy lived in Vienna. He studied philosophy and he worked in a drugstore. And they were going and they looked for him. And also I made up a
You had reporters from the Netherlands off in Austria looking for... Okay.
And I thought I had done it pretty well. I even had arranged a post address. I found a friend of a friend, a lady who lived there. And I said, whenever you receive a mail from Marek van der Yacht, please send it back to New York. And this was the official address that publisher gave a correspondent in Vienna. And this man, one morning early, knocked on the door of this lady and he said, does Marek van der Yacht live here? And she was a little bit in shock because he had expected some mail, but not a living person standing in front of her door. So she locked the door and she shouted something like, he moved away. And from that point on, things started to unraveling. The rumors started getting bigger and bigger that Marek van der Yacht wasn't a real person.
So by the time Marek van der Yacht won the debut novel award.
Yes.
Somebody made a mistake because you can't win the debut novel award twice.
Exactly. And then I still, people ask me the question, is it you? Are you Marek van der Yacht? And I kept denying it. And also I had, there was a picture, so you need this picture on the back of your book. And I found a guy living in Orlando. And I took his picture, and he was completely, I said, of course. And I thought, who in the Netherlands would know this guy from Orlando? And my plan was to send this guy from Orlando working for Walt Disney, Disney World there, to the Netherlands to pick up the prize. But because of all these rumors, the organizers of the of this award said whoever comes to pick up the award and the money needs to show a picture ID.
Uh-huh.
And that was a problem, of course.
Now, arts journalists, as brilliant as most of them are, sometimes object a little bit to having their tails pulled. Did you anger some of the people in the Netherlands with this?
Oh, yes. And I was surprised how, because I thought it's part of a literary game. So many authors before me, like the Pessoa, the Portuguese author, who had many, many different names, and even all his different characters basically were attacking each other. So I was not the one who invented this kind of spiel, if you can call it this way. But really, some people thought that it was just because of the money of this prize that I was like a money grabber, or that I was really a fraud. That I was like some people going to the bank and defraud and steal from the bank. And I was surprised at how fearful some journalists attacked me. But I have to say, other people came to my defense and said it's part of literature.
Now, where on this tortured path did you decide to make your move to New York City?
Shortly after my first novel, Blue Mondays, came out in the Netherlands.
Right. So you were already in New York when this flap was unfolding.
Absolutely.
In the Netherlands.
I was already, yes. I was living a few years already in New York. And it was also, it was another mistake I'd made. I had an email address, a German email address. But somehow, I didn't know that at that time, a technician found out that the emails weren't sent from Vienna, Austria, but from New York. So I think that was one of the biggest things that pointed out in my direction.
The move to New York, though, gave you back something that you'd had when you were younger, and that was a certain anonymity. You'd yes. reached a point where it was kind of hard for you to hang out in a cafe in Amsterdam.
Well, especially in Amsterdam, after Blue Mondays came out, suddenly I was on a few television shows, and people I didn't know started talking to me about my book. And of course, in the first few, that's very pleasant. You feel, hey, I am somebody at last. But I think also because shortly after that, I started writing a column for a newspaper. And in a way, it takes also away from the freedom when you write, when you know, okay, this column will be in a newspaper Friday morning. If I go to a cafe Friday evening, people might comment on it, or people I know. I don't know. But this wasn't the reason I moved to New York. The reason I moved to New York was purely for love. So that was a very, and it was long decided before Blue Mondays came out. But it was a good coincidence.
It's also a great city to disappear into.
Absolutely.
Is it still useful for you that way? Do you still find that you can meet characters or put yourself into a situation in New York City that you can draw material from and then use it in a book?
Yes, still.
For example?
I think for an author, maybe for some artists it's different, but for an author like me, everywhere you go, with every person you speak to, it's just one detail that you see, a small thing, you hear a small thing. Like yesterday I had to go to a pediatrician. And she interrupted the conversation, and she had a phone call apparently to a man who was chasing her. And she said, "And I'll never make appointments at short notice. I value myself much too much for that." And I was looking at this older lady, and I thought, this is a great comment. And suddenly I had this fantasy about this lady as she was looking so seriously. And I thought, who is this guy chasing her? And what's he? This is a small, very banal, very simple example, but this happens all the day, of course. When you go
so out. Atlantic City or motels in Yonkers or all-night delis, these are all places where everywhere. You've actually pulled images or people or
yes.
or moments from.
Yeah, there was a time I was really interested in casinos. The first time when I had a friend, I met him in Amsterdam, also because of Blue Mondays. He had read a book, he started a conversation, and he told me, I'm a professional gambler. And by that time, I didn't know anything about professional gambling at all. And he invited me to Vegas. And he was he was a professional gambler. Not as big as he told me he was in Amsterdam. He said, I'm the king of professional gamblers. He wasn't at all. But I visited casinos quite heavily. Not only to bet, but also to look at people.
Casinos figure prominently in the new book, Phantom Pain. Just a quick overview for people who haven't read the book. How do you describe what the book Phantom Pain is about?
It's about an author living in the Netherlands who used to have some fame. And he's married to a psychologist, his wife. She's called the Fairy Tale Princess.
He calls her the Fairy Tale Princess.
He calls her the Fairy Tale Princess, exactly. And he has also severe money problems. He's living on all these credit cards, and he tries to pay off one with the other. And because of that, he promised a book to a German publisher, a cookbook. But he can't really start writing the book. He's always postponing it. And one day he finds a little card in front of his door from a lady from the Netherlands who says, "I have something for you. I'd like to give it to you." And with her, he starts an affair. And also he writes the cookbook, which is going to be called Cooking After Auschwitz. And this book is first a bestseller in Germany, then in Austria, then all over the world. And so it helps him getting out of the money problems, but also it's because he really has these literary aspirations that destroys him in a way.
He's never really sure whether or not the book that he has written is the piece of art that he hoped would make him famous.
Exactly. So, yeah.
I want to ask you to read a little piece from Phantom Pain. This is okay. The introduction to our writer's mother, right?
Yes.
Grandma Mailman?
Yeah, exactly. And this is the son of Mailman, of the author who is speaking here.
Okay.
A couple of times each year, Grandma Mailman would come to visit. She would take up residence at a Sheraton, a two-minute walk from our house. When they'd give her a room at the front, she would complain about the noisy traffic. When she was put at the back, she complained about the noisy neighbors. During the day, she would clean our house or babysit for me and complained that my mother was a lousy housekeeper and that it was just like her son to marry a slattern. I never met my grandfather. Apparently, he was a famous tennis player. My grandmother always spoke of her husband as the famous tennis player Aaron Mailman, but in reality, he never made it past 268th in the world rankings. When he saw that he was about to be bumped out of Wimbledon in the first round again, he lost his self-control, climbed over the net, and attacked his opponent, a young man from Chile, with his racket. When his opponent tried to run away, my grandfather fell to the grass and sank his teeth into the man's leg. The Chilean had to be taken to the hospital with a split lip and a wound to his calf, and the Tennis Federation suspended my grandfather for life. At a press conference, my grandfather later claimed that the Tennis Federation had put narcotics in his tea and that he was the victim of a conspiracy. It was the only time he ever made the front pages, with headlines like, "Tennis player turns mad dog." Whenever anything bad happened to him later in life, he would always shout, "Ha, I bet the Tennis Federation could tell us more about this." My father grew up with a myth that his father was an important and famous tennis player, until he found out that his father had never made it past 268th in the world rankings, but still told checkout girls, "I'm Aaron Mailman, the famous tennis player from the 30s. Fortunately, by the time my father wrote his first real book, 268th in the world, which rocketed him to fame, my grandfather had been consumed by dementia. He sat in a chair by the window, and the world went by. Thanks to dementia, he never had to read how, in 268 in the world, his son portrayed him as a tyrant and a mythomaniac who always told his family when they went to a restaurant, 'Tell them I'm Aaron Mailman, the famous tennis player from the 30s, and I don't like chat potatoes.'"
That from Phantom Pain, a new novel in English, read to us by Arnon Grunberg, the author. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join my conversation with the young man whose work is very well known in Europe and just becoming well known in this country. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is Arnon Grunberg. He's a Dutch novelist who's been living in Manhattan for the past 9 years. His most recent novel, published in English, is Phantom Pain. It won the ACO, the highest literary honor in the Netherlands, the equivalent of the Booker. It was written, you said, Arnon, back in 2000.
Then it came out. I wrote it back in
99. Published in 2000 in Dutch.
In Dutch, yes.
And just now out in English.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yep.
That's a long wait.
Yeah, it's a long way. Well, it was last year it came out in the UK, and then it always takes time for a translator to do the job. Sometimes it even takes more time for him and for me than to write a book. And there are not too many good translators, so sometimes they're busy and you have to wait.
I was sitting here listening to you read from Phantom Pain and wondering what it's like as a writer to read what you've written in another language from the language that you originally wrote it in?
It's a little bit strange, but most of the time it still feels like it's my own work. But sometimes it's just a word that I say, hey, interesting word.
I must remember that if I ever write in English.
Yes, exactly.
But the style is in many ways what has attracted the attention of a lot of people in Europe, because you write short, declarative sentences. Your dialogue's got lots of sparkle to it. This is not the style that most people would expect, even in novels being written today in Holland, right?
No, there are many. No, it's not something you would. That's true. But when I started writing Blue Mondays, I just wanted to tell. That was one of the goals for myself. I wanted to write it as if I was speaking to somebody, as if I was telling a story to somebody in a cafe or in a coffee house, wherever. And I didn't want to construct to use too many metaphors or to try to be too sophisticated. I just wanted, I wanted to come as close to spoken language as possible. And later I changed it in my later books, but especially for Blue Mondays, that was true.
Was the book written on some kind of a dare?
In a way it was, yes. I never thought of being an author. I did several jobs. I tried to be an actor. And then I had my own publishing house. And I was publishing German books in Dutch translation. And I went bankrupt. And I tried to sell my publishing house to another publisher. Because I had a huge amount of books waiting there to be sold to bookstores. So I went to the Frankfurt Book Fair and I spoke to a Dutch publisher. And I told him everything. And he took me out for dinner. And
did you tell him the truth, or were there some embellishments in what you told him?
Basically, no. I was quite honest at that time.
You don't have to say at that time. I was curious.
At that time, no. That evening, I was completely honest. I didn't know. And at the end of the evening, he said, well, to be honest, I like your company, but I'm not interested in buying your publishing house. But if you want to write a novel for us, please go ahead. Call me. And I never called him because it was like, you know, something said in a cafe or in a bar. But when I came back to Amsterdam, he called me. And he said, I'm serious. So I handed in a first chapter. I got an advance payment. And I started writing. And he always, especially in the beginning, you don't have the discipline. So he was really calling me every 2 weeks and say, come in, show me the next chapter. I'll take you out for lunch. I didn't have money at all at that time. So that's how I wrote my first book.
Now, Blue Mondays, the first book, has as its main character Arnon Grunberg. And this caused you some difficulty in the way that people responded to the book, right? Because figuring out what was true and what was not, or what was real and what was not.
Exactly. And that was, by the way, one of the reasons that in the first novel by Marek van der Jacht, my pseudonym, I used the main character. I gave the name main character there, the name Marek van der Jacht, to show how easy it is to make believe that it's all completely true. And of course, I thought about it for a while in Blue Mondays, should I name him completely different? But I thought, because certain things we have in common, we both grew up in Amsterdam, we went to the same high school, the family background is more or less the same, I'll name him Arnon Grunberg to make the confusion a little bigger.
Now, the family background that you talk about, your parents are both from Germany.
Yep.
And your, help me with this, your dad hid during the war, your mother was in the camps?
Yes.
And how much a part of being a child of Holocaust survivors sent you off to creating the types of characters that you create? Do you draw a straight link back to why am I today the way I am today?
Well, of course, everybody's influenced by their parents. But one of the most striking things for me, you compare as a child your parents to other parents, was not so much the Holocaust, but first of all, that I spoke German.
Right.
Which was... And also, when they spoke Dutch, they did with a heavy accent. So everyone, hey, your parents are German. And of course, being a German in the Netherlands in the 70s was not something good. They hated the Germans still, and they still do to this day. And also, my parents were extremely old. My father, he isn't alive anymore. He was born in 1912. So everybody thought that my parents were my grandparents. So that was, for me, much more confusing than the fact, the whole war thing. I was very much used to the war. My mother talked about Auschwitz over dinner. She used to say things when she was angry. In Auschwitz, I had a better time than with you. So for me, it was not something very sacred. It was okay. Of course, I knew what was happening there, but my mother talked about it very, without much emotion, very down to earth. As a matter of fact, so it was for me not something to be afraid of very much. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but for many people, it is a part of who is such a part of who they are, it becomes a part of almost the religion. It becomes something, as awful an experience as it was, it becomes something almost sacred and untouchable for that reason.
And that's how I have an 8-year older sister, and she was very much, she became a very Zionistic. She moved to Israel. She made 7 children. She's living on the West Bank in a settlement. And for her, it's really like something sacred.
It's still.
And we really disagree about this whole subject. For her, the Holocaust is, you cannot compare to anything else. It's outside human history, basically. And I really think that's very it's dangerous and wrong to put it outside, to place it, to make it into something too sacred.
And so when you create in Polish Jewish cuisine in 69 recipes a runaway success, particularly when it's published in German, are there people who go, Arnon, you've gone too far. You can't make light of something which was such an awful event.
Oh, yeah. Especially the Jewish newspaper in the Netherlands, the Weekly Magazine. I think they reviewed the book quite badly, also because of that. But other people, and I've been to Germany. It was also based, many things of that book are based on my experience when my first book came out in Germany. I made a reading tour, and I went to many places. And like in this book, this remark, like by the Austrian president, he said to the author, "You're the first Jew I ever see laughing. I'm so glad about it." And I remember that there was this reading I had to do, and a German woman came to me and said, "I'm so glad I see you laughing. You're the first Jew I ever see laughing on television. They always look so sad." So, and I think that's funny. I can't blame her for that. I mean, that's growing up as a German, being a German after World War II isn't that easy either.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Arnon Grunberg. He is the author most recently of a book available in English in this country called Phantom Pain. And the relationship, Arnon, between the young man who does a couple of cameos, the son of the writer, Harpo, and is his father, it's a curious relationship. The father can't sit across from the table, really, and have an intelligent relationship with people. He does his best work when he's writing letters to people. He can only relate to his son through letters.
Yes.
Are you a letter writer yourself?
Yeah? Absolutely. I used, before I ever wrote anything, I wrote many letters. I had this, and now it's over, but I had this, I don't know why, I had this phone fear. Speaking on the phone to people, I found it terrible. So I always, before, it was long before email, I used the fax, I used letters a lot. And I remember that when I was 18 or 19, I fell in love with a waitress in an Italian restaurant. I used to go there for coffee, but I never really dared to speak to her, and I only know her first name. So I started sending letters to the restaurant. And I thought, at that time I was very, I think, an optimist. I thought, if my letters will be beautiful enough, she will respond one day. So I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop writing the letters. I think I sent her 120 letters. But also, I was so ashamed of sending her all these letters, I didn't dare to go there anymore. So I was stuck.
And so that relationship was never consummated?
Never, never, never. Although after 2 years we met each other and I invited her for coffee and she came over and it was a very tense cup of coffee.
Did she get the letters?
She got them.
She knew who'd written them?
Yes.
Interesting.
And they were speaking about me in the restaurant. I always ordered penne al pesto, and they called me the pesto eater. Oh, there's another letter from the pesto eater.
And they would all read it, I suppose.
They all read it and laugh about it, of course.
Your most cleverly drawn characters are all, in their own way, kind of outsiders. They're not people who fit in well. Robert Melman doesn't fit anywhere where he is, whether or not he's traveling Europe as an old man or trying to make his way as a writer in America. Is that something that you bring a little bit of yourself to, this notion of being an outsider or someone who's able to sort of step outside and look back and regard himself?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, absolutely. And I don't think being an outsider is only negative. I think for an author, it's his natural position, because being an outsider, you can look at you're a good observer. And also, if you might be able to look at yourself at a little distance. And I think also that's very important for an author.
So what's home for you? Do you feel most at home when you get off an airplane in Amsterdam or in New York?
I feel at home in hotels. I always had this, when I was younger, I always dreamt of living in hotels. I think place. Of course, I live in New York, and I feel very. I would not want to go back to Amsterdam, but when I have to this September, I have to go for 6 weeks to Budapest. I think I will. I think a big city. I wouldn't feel at ease for more than 3 or 4 weeks in a small village. How much I like it for a holiday, but in a big city, I can feel easily at home.
I want to take our first caller, who's joining us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Vonder. Is that right?
That's right.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you have Arnon on today. I have two kind of traditional questions. First one is influences, particularly in Dutch literature, what his influences might be, especially in relationship to the sort of, quote, great Dutch writers, or supposedly, Cees 't Noteboom and Harry Mulisch. And the second question is, he alluded to earlier about translators and there not being many good translators, and yet there is a very strict Dutch translation organization in Amsterdam through which all translators must be approved for getting their official text published. I was just wondering the politics of translating and how he's found that in Holland in particular.
Okay, I'll answer your second question first. There's indeed this foundation in the Netherlands, and they have this strict policy. And I'm not a member of this foundation, and I can't say anything about it. And it might be sometimes I think they're a little bit too strict. But in a way, it's good that they protect what their objective is to try to protect the original work. And of course, I think that's a good objective. That's
the French do the same thing, do they not? They're very, very careful.
They're very careful. I believe the Germans, they try to do the same thing. Yes. But of course, maybe sometimes they're also blinded by that, and they could find more translators who are good, but they're just not looking enough. I'm not sure. Maybe that's the case.
Does it mean that material which ought to be translated sometimes is not, or ends up being translated in such a way that it's not read as widely as it could be?
I don't know. I remember there was with a colleague of mine. Her English translation wasn't approved by this foundation because it was too free. It was not literal. And I think the author was happy about it. So that was a little bit strange. When the author is happy about the translation, why would the foundation get in the way between the author and the translator? You know, I think this woman is able to read English. Why would suddenly, this was a little bit like too much of politics involved in literature. And to answer the first question about influence, of course I've read Noteboom and Mulisch, but there's another Dutch author, very well known in the Netherlands, but not so much well known outside. His name is W.F. Hermans, and I like him much better than the other two mentioned.
Is he translated into English as well?
Not so much. I think that he died, and they're trying to. But you know, it's so hard for a deaf author to find a publisher. They always say a foreign author is difficult enough. Please, he has to be alive.
But the other thing about your work that makes it work as well as it does in English is that we're back to the question of style here, Arnon, and that when you're writing the way you do, some people would look at that and say that's an American style of writing, short, sharp sentences. I don't know whether or not that would pass muster with a European audience to say, well, that's American style. But
at this time, at this moment, no, that's whiskey. But no, of course, and like this Phantom Pain is set in the U.S. 90% of, and many dialogues I heard, basically I translated from English back into Dutch, and afterwards they got back translated back into English. Yes, of course. So I don't object to that, to how you described it. No.
Let me get you to read again from Phantom Pain. This is the this is when Mr. Melman is a little bit like you in that he's going for the regular place for his coffee every morning. What do we need to know about the this little scene here? Because in a way, it's sort of just talking about writing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the beginning of the book. He's still postponing all the work he has to do, and he goes every morning to a place for his breakfast. Basically, I got up, paid for my two coffees and the orange juice, and thought of an opening line for my article on Svevo. Before I left, I bent down to say goodbye to the little fat boy in a stroller. His mother smiled at me, as she should have, of course. Little fat boys in strollers are none too popular. I still had absolutely no idea how I must live, but I'd got better at pretending. What could I say about Svevo? Why Svevo? Why me? And for whom or what had I got myself into such deep debt? For the thankless. I stood there and wrote on my little notepad, "He went bankrupt on the thankless." I'd started drafting my own obituary around the time. If there's one thing you should never leave to others, it's your own obituary. I'd once told someone that writing was a profession like any other. Some people sold shoes, others wrote. I could no longer make that claim. Writing was a form of cannibalism. First, you devoured life, down to the last scrap. Then you spit it up. For the writer, life was a tainted muscle, one that was all green and slimy. It was already in your mouth, but you could spit it up just in time, before the food poisoning really kicked in. From the coffee house, I walked to my local newspaper stand, where I bought $50 worth of scratch-off lottery tickets. At crucial moments, I fell back into my old, familiar cannibal's role. I had discovered scratch-off lottery tickets about 4 months before that, and I decided that when it came to manual therapy, very little could beat the scratch-off lottery ticket. Sometimes, when I had to go out to dinner with my wife's colleagues, I would buy about a dozen tickets for everyone. I would hand them out after the main course. I always enjoy seeing what scratch-off tickets bring out in a person. Besides, it saves conversation. Scratching people don't talk.
Arnon Grunberg, reading from his new novel, Phantom Pain. What do you see when someone scratches a lottery ticket? Why do you enjoy watching that?
It's like watching a tennis player. There's this, even when they don't admit it, there's this hope, the tense, this suspense, and they're completely, the concentration. That's nice.
And the possibility that they'll...
That their life, yeah. Even if they say, oh, it's just a game, but you feel that there's more to it.
Everybody knows their life can change,
yeah.
Right? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, Arnon Grunberg. We're talking about his latest novel, Phantom Pain, but also his work and his home and his notions of writing. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Arnon Grunberg is my guest this hour. He has three of his books available in English. They are Blue Mondays, Silent Extras, and a brand new one, Phantom Pain. Other ones, Story of My Baldness is also available in English, but don't be fooled by the name of the author on that. It is also Arnon Grunberg. We talked about that a little earlier in the program. Our number for you to join my conversation this hour, 1-800-423-TALK. And next to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I have a question for Mr. Grunberg.
Yeah.
I was wondering, when you're writing, what is the, during your process, when do you decide that you've said enough in your story? When do you say that that's the ending?
Well, I do many drafts of, it's not that I just do one draft. When I do a novel or a short story, I do the first draft and then I go back and I delete a lot. And I think it's a gut feeling. It's something, and very often, you know, from the beginning, more or less where you want to go to. If you don't know the last sentence, you know more or less the ending already. So you can be surprised while writing, and then you might change the idea and you think, I would like to end somewhere else. But it's a very natural feeling, you know, I've said enough. And the more you do it, the more you know that you feel more secure by just knowing, okay, here, we don't enough.
Tom, is this a problem that you have with your writing?
Yeah, a lot of times I do.
That's what editors are for, right? Or the Iowa Writers Workshop. I don't know, tough to get into that, but thanks for your calls. Nice to have you with us. To Exeter, New Hampshire, Anthony's next. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, my name is Tolan. I came to the States when I was 13 from the Netherlands.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Very interested in this. I'm curious, if I have the option to read the last book in English or in Dutch, would you recommend it in Dutch or in English, given that you've lived in the United States for a few years now? The other question I have is whether you dream in English, and I was wondering how old you are. I'm 43 myself, and I'm very interested in the aspect of your growing up in the Netherlands with the German background. I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm 33 years old, and it depends. Writing, reading my book in English or Dutch depends how good your Dutch is. If you are able to read an author in the original language, I would always recommend doing that. But if your Dutch isn't good enough anymore, then I think English is a perfect second option. And the third question, what was the third question?
I think you covered the two principles. I mean, I wanted to go just one step further, if I can, with this, the language that you read it in, because you made the point earlier that it's a story about life in America with an English language dialogue. Yeah. And I think that may be why Tone's sort of going, well, maybe that'd be the best place to go.
Maybe, yeah. So, no, indeed, I take it back. I think go for the English translation. That's better. Yeah. Oh, he asked also in which language I dream.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, sorry.
I think still in Dutch. I'm quite positive. Maybe sometimes another person is speaking to me in English in my dreams, but most of the language is still Dutch.
What do you make of the way the literary world is constructed where, and I did it here on the program, introduced you as a Dutch novelist because you were born in the Netherlands. Are you any... I mean, does that mean that country should have and ought to have a claim to whatever you succeed at doing?
I'm not sure. It's a little bit strange because, of course, in Amsterdam, no one would introduce me as a Dutch author because they're so... you know what I mean? It's like I'm from a different place. I'm from somewhere else. So suddenly I'm Dutch.
So would they say the...
But it's not... I don't feel profoundly Dutch. I mean, my parents weren't from the Netherlands. I lived there 23 years. Of course, I feel Dutch only because of the language and because maybe of Amsterdam. But even outside of Amsterdam, there's like with New York and the USA, there's so much difference between Amsterdam and the rest of the Netherlands. And I have no... Even when it comes like this summer, we had the soccer championships in Europe, and it's a big thing in Europe. And in the Netherlands, everybody was hysteric. And I to be honest, when there was a game between Germany and the Netherlands, I hoped that Germany would win.
It's a good thing Tone hung up the phone here. You know, we don't want to start any real duels on the air. Okay. But hard to know, I guess. Hard to make some of those decisions and to figure out on what basis you... it's why I asked you earlier what you think, about where home. You think of about home. Because if you've been 9 years in New York and developed some comfort there, it's almost comfort in a city where everybody comes from somewhere
else.
Yeah,
exactly. I never felt a stranger there. Never from the beginning. The first months I lived in Queens, even not there, no. And I thought eventually I would go back after a year, but after 3 months I went back to the Netherlands, I gave up my apartment, and I decided to stay.
And you do writing about the United States for Dutch
newspaper,
audience now,
yes.
Newspaper, magazines.
From the beginning I did it. Yes.
Now, first, is that fiction, nonfiction?
First it was really mostly nonfiction. It was called Letter from the U.S. And later I changed into, because I travel so much, it's now called Grunberg Around the World. And it's like a travel column. And sometimes it's still close to nonfiction, but I feel free to change names and to add a little things. But when it comes, they don't do fact-checking, let me put it that way.
Now, relations between Europe and the United States have seen better days.
Yeah.
How do you find a place for your voice in explaining, talking about America to Dutch readers?
Well, there is, as everywhere else in Europe, I guess, also in the Netherlands, this profound sense that the U.S. is at the moment nothing more than Bush. And when I do an article on the U.S., I try to correct that. And also it's like a little bit too easy to blame for all the wrongs in the world. There's this tendency, also among people of my generation, to blame the U.S. for all the wrongs in the world, also in the Netherlands.
It's pretty easy intellectual currency,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yes. And also, I think also this, like, oh, we are sophisticated, but because we are against the U.S., that makes us already intellectual, which, of course, is...
Do you get in trouble if you are... Writing against that point of view for...
Sometimes things got me in trouble. After I always do this, every 2 weeks I have this column, and after September 11, back in 2001, they asked me to do an extra column on on that day. I was in New York, and that was the piece that really got me in trouble. I never got so many angry.
What did you say?
I just explained the whole. I live on 37 and Park, and I explained everything what happened there. I didn't went down. I just explained the conversations I had with the people, and I ended up in a hotel. And there were some just people. There was no food because there were many people. And just like I wrote down all these conversations about food, basically people were having, and it was considered so completely inconsiderate. As if I, and there was even one person who compared me to a Nazi. But the funny thing is, a few months later, I read in Harper's Magazine an article about victims. They were also complaining that they didn't get, that they rather would have a cheese sandwich than a sausage sandwich. So after a few months, suddenly, and now it's in a collection, now it could be done. But at that moment, I was attacked from every side.
Going back to the phone lines to Santee, South Carolina. Shelby's with us. Hi, Shelby.
Hello.
Hello? Yeah, go ahead, Shelby.
Yes, I just want to say congratulations to him, and I'm really glad. I'm Jewish. I'm a Creole Jew that grew up in Louisiana and had to do 2 years in Bet El in Israel, and the seriousness of it is just, there's just no humor anymore, and that's not good, and I can't wait to read your book. That's all I want to say. Bye.
No, Shelby, don't hang up. Are you saying that the seriousness is here in America, or you saw that only when you're in Israel, or...?
It's all over the world. It's just much too serious. We need to laugh more. I think Mouse was the last book I read by Art Spiegelman, I think it was, that did it. That was pretty funny. But there's just, the humor's gone. I mean, it's just taken, it's gotten way too sacred, just like he said.
Do you agree with that, Arnold?
Yeah, I think, but it's even more than only related to the whole Jewish question. I think the whole identity question is taken much too seriously. People think suddenly I am this. We spoke a little bit about it, about your home. People like the whole thing. The whole thing. People think, okay, I'm Dutch. That means that I'm this and this and this and more. And I think you can play much more with your own identity than people think. And I think it's also good to know that there's a lot of fiction in your identity, a lot of myth.
And with the change in Europe, does that make a difference for people who claim some kind of European heritage? Do you become European instead of Dutch? Do you become a Jewish writer from Europe instead of a Dutch writer who speaks German? You know what I'm saying?
Europe is very unpopular in all of Europe. Nobody feels European. I think it's like a whole concept isn't appealing to anyone. And they're trying hard, but it's like even with the elections, at the European elections, nobody cares about Europe. It's like, no, it's not. And you see the opposite. You see that people suddenly define themselves. There's this growth of nationalism, like we are Dutch, we are better, or we are French. I'm amazed about that. I'm amazed that really intelligent people suddenly can say things like, the French are so much better than the US or so much better than Germany. And they're very sophisticated. They can speak intelligently about Schopenhauer, and suddenly this comes out.
Did your father live to see your career as a writer take off?
No, he died before. He was very. He's in my first book. He got sick. He got this a brain attack, and he was he couldn't move anymore. No, he died before.
Was that a source of some disappointment for you?
I had a very difficult relationship with my father during my. During my adolescence, and we couldn't really speak to each other. And after he got sick, it got a little bit better. And he was sitting in a wheelchair, and I had to take him out and he always liked his beer or a glass of wine. And my mother didn't allow him that anymore. So whenever I went out with him, he said, "Let's go into a cafe and let's have a glass of wine." Although he couldn't really drink because he was sleeping, so I was sneaked with him into a cafe, and then I offered him a glass of wine. And I have good memories of that. Although my mother really disapproved of that, of course.
Disapproved of
me going with him in a wheelchair to a cafe and giving him wine.
Well, what about your writing? Is she?
In the beginning, she was furious. When my first book came out, she said, "This is the last thing I needed. I will never talk to you anymore. I don't have a son anymore."
Oh, my God.
But then suddenly it was in the newspaper on television, and neighbors started saying, "Hey, we saw your son on television." And she changed her mind. And now she's very proud.
Is it fame? Did that turn it around for her?
Well, of course, she's also a woman who says one thing when she's very angry. Like she could throw things out of the window when she was angry. Once we were in the train, she threw out the luggage. We were in the station. She was so angry with my father. She opened the window. We were So she's this kind of woman.
Like
she is.
Somebody throwing books out of a window.
Exactly. But I know she would change her mind. But of course, fame helps.
I ask you about it because it does seem to touch in the writing of yours that I've seen. Melman says, when you're the only one who thinks of you as an important writer, that's awkward. But when 10,000 other people also think of you as an important writer, you're a success.
Yeah, that's the definition. When you can people convince that your idea of the world, of how you see yourself is true, then suddenly you're allowed to do many things.
But it's almost as much of a curse as a blessing, because then as soon as you get that kind of acknowledgement, people begin to think that they own
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. It's a prison. And that's also what I want to show in this book, how it really destroys this mailman, how he can't get rid of it anymore, how he is suddenly only nothing more than his cookbook author. And he wants to speak about his other books, about other things, but he can't anymore.
So what next for you? Are you going to find another nom de plume and escape the history of Arnon Grunberg in the United States? What's next?
No, I think I'll continue just writing and living in New York. And I think my gut feeling is that I can live there anonymously as for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years without a problem.
33 years old. Now you decided you like this writing thing, you're going to stick with it?
I always thought I would stop, but the more I do it, it's like addictive. I can't, no, it's hard for me. I think I will never stop. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll go back to writing letters to people. Maybe I won't publish anymore. I'm not sure. But I cannot, this feeling of waking up and then having a cup of coffee and going to your computer. No, even after 5 days holidays, I really miss it. That's why I like this work for newspapers and magazines so much, because you always have the deadline. And sometimes they ask me, do you want to take a holiday in the summer? I say, no.
Maybe it's just you can't deny talent, which you have. And it's been a pleasure to have you with me on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Arnon Grunberg, his most recent novel published in English is Phantom Pain. Our program is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Micah Sieber and Nadia Osayev. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Thank you.